Has Coral Gables become a part of a human smuggling route? How do cities profit off red light cameras? And is the city of Miami getting the $10 million promised for new parks? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Helen Acevedo. Tim Padgett is on assignment this week. In the next hour, we'll talk about how the city of Coral Gables became an endpoint for smuggled migrants between the Bahamas and South Florida in recent weeks. We'll also look into red light camera tickets and how cities like Aventura are making major profits from them. And we'll examine the City of Miami Commission's recent vote to shift millions meant for new parks back to Miami Freedom Park, the future home of the Inter-Miami soccer team. All that coming up right after the news. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. Tim Padgett is on assignment this week. If you're familiar with the city of Coral Gables, take a moment to think about it for a second. What do you picture? It's beautiful tree-canopied streets, Mediterranean Revival architecture, fine dining. The idea of the city being a key endpoint for human smuggling probably doesn't cross your mind. But it is, or at least it has been in the last couple of weeks. Since the start of this year, the Coral Gables Police Department has detained more than 40 people, mostly Chinese, being smuggled through the city's neighborhoods after arriving by boat from the Bahamas. They've also arrested 7 suspected smugglers. So how and why has one of Miami-Dade County's most affluent neighborhoods become a key point for these kinds of operations? Joining me now to make sense of it all is the Miami Herald's police and breaking news reporter, Milena Malaver, who's been following this story. Milena, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hey, Milena. So for context, could you take us back to how the city of Coral Gables even found out about possible human smuggling in the area?
Yeah, so it's safe to say that Coral Gables Police Department had some intel on human smuggling in the area for quite some time. But what really unraveled and brought this to light was a witness, somebody who was driving by and saw this happen in about mid-January.
Yeah, so according to your reporting, a woman had seen some strange activity near the R. Hardy Matheson Preserve, right? What did she describe to officers?
Yeah, so this woman, who's a longtime Coral Gables resident, she knows the area well. She was driving down Old Cutler Road, and she notices a U-Haul van in a Toyota parked near R. Hardy Matheson Preserve, and she sort of thought to herself, that's a little strange. I don't see any fishing equipment, which is common because it's a common fishing spot. So she thought, that's a little strange. But then what kind of sent her into a panic was she saw a woman getting shoved into the Toyota Corolla by a man. So she sort of turns around and goes to where she had seen a Coral Gables police officer earlier, and she tells him basically that she thinks somebody could be getting abducted at 9:30 in the morning on Old Cutler Road. And this officer, you know, immediately takes off. They issue a bolo for the Toyota Corolla and the U-Haul, and officers, you know, pretty quickly pull over these two cars, and, you know, lo and behold, they discover about 20 migrants in the back of this van.
Yeah, Milena, and this was just the first of these events, right? There was a second smuggling case as well in Coral Gables, right?
Yes. So on January 17th was the first one, and then less than 2 weeks later, on January 28th, the same scenario sort of played out. A resident of Coral Gables, a witness, saw some people being loaded into a van near the Snapper Creek's Lakes neighborhood and alerted the police. And, you know, once we thought, okay, this is kind of strange, but by the second time this happened, we knew that we were maybe looking at something bigger.
Right. And at the top, I mentioned that most of the people that have been detained are Chinese. That's the majority of them. But there are like different people from different countries in these operations as well, right?
Yes. So the smugglers themselves have been Cuban and Dominican on the most part. The people who are being smuggled in, at least through Coral Gables, the majority have been Chinese. But we've also seen people from Ecuador. The woman that actually got shoved into the car was a Brazilian woman.
Okay, and are these people who've been detained being held in immigration detention centers?
Yes. So we know that from looking at the federal documents, these people are usually taken to some type of border patrol station, like the one up in Dania Beach. And many of them face immediate deportation. Those who can hire a lawyer and put an asylum claim.
Yeah, and Milena, in your story, you mentioned that the Bahamas has long served as a departure point for migrants traveling to Florida, but mainly for Haitians and Cubans. Does the island nation make it easier for migrants to travel there?
Well, the Bahamas has sort of a long established, let's call it a relationship with smuggling Haitians and Cubans. So that relationship is there and it's been going on for years. But speaking specifically to Chinese migrants, I mean, yes, because Chinese nationals do not require a visa to enter the Bahamas. So these people can, just have their Chinese passports, take a regular commercial flight to the Bahamas, and then organize, getting on a boat from the Bahamas to South Florida. So yes, it's fairly easy for Chinese nationals to enter the Bahamas.
And that's the suspected route authorities believe these Chinese migrants are taking. But in the past, Chinese migrants would travel to Ecuador rather than the Bahamas, right? Why is that?
Yes. So we spoke to various experts on this, including Mr. Leland Lazarus, who is the Associate Director of National Security at FIU's Jack D. Gordon Institute for Public Policy. And so we know that Chinese migrants would often take this route of flying from China to Turkey to Ecuador. And then trek along the Darien Gap. And what's important to note is that up until July, Chinese nationals could enter Ecuador with no visa, but that's no longer the case. They now need a visa to enter Ecuador.
And why did Ecuador remove that availability of a visa to Chinese migrants? Or sorry, Chinese individuals.
Well, we can only assume it was a way to sort of secure that US Mexico border as a way of working with authorities on securing any immigration issues that they were having.
Okay. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's police and breaking news reporter, Milena Malaver, about how Coral Gables became a key endpoint for human smuggling. So, Milena, are Bahamian and U.S. officials concerned about the recent uptick in Chinese nationals taking this route? What are some of the things they're analyzing?
Yes, so both Bahamian and US officials have expressed their concerns about this route. And specifically, Bahamian officials are really trying to figure out the scope of this smuggling. So what they told us is that they're looking at whether this is part of a larger smuggling operation or whether this is a growing wave of Chinese migrants who've been seeking asylum at the US-Mexico border, but are now diverting to taking sea routes.
Okay, and that was actually my next question. The tightening of U.S.-Mexico borders has made it more difficult for migrants to enter the country by land. Have U.S. authorities told you anything about migrants possibly diverting to sea as a result?
Yes, but more specifically, Bahamian officials. So in the Bahamas, they wanted more Chinese tourists to come, so they lifted this visa. But now they're, saying that they're maybe seeing some consequences of that because of the uptick in migrants now taking the sea route to South Florida from the Bahamas.
Yeah. And Milena, as you've reported, the United States has seen an influx of Chinese migrants in the last couple of years, specifically after the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in Florida. U.S. Customs and Border Protection stopped 78% or 317 more Chinese migrants in 2024 compared to 2020. What are some of the reasons experts are attributing to this increase?
Yeah, so the experts we've spoken to, have described China's COVID-19 response and lockdowns as draconian. So many, small businesses suffered, and they were just never able to recover financially. So these are really just people looking for jobs, and they hear that there's a plentiful amount of jobs in the United States, so they're seeking that out. And yes, Florida has seen a 78% increase since 2020, but that's only about 300 people. And we know that NBC News spoke to one of these Chinese migrants, and she told them that the reason she left China was because of the retaliation she faced when she spoke out against, China's sort of zero COVID policy. And she was willing to pay upwards of $30,000 to leave the country. So the simplest answer is that these are people just really, seeking a better life, as, we've heard time and time again.
These migrants are using the Bahamas as a jump-off point, and they make it to South Florida. Milena, why do you think Coral Gables, which, as I mentioned at the onset, is a very affluent area, not really known for something like this, was the place where smugglers decided to land, for lack of a better word?
I mean, South Florida has always been a key spot for smuggling. And these smugglers are always going to find a way to bring people in. And once a certain spot is uncovered by authorities, they'll move on to the next. And I think at just one point, they found a spot that worked for them in Coral Gables. Coral Gables has a ton of waterways. Now that this one has been uncovered, chances are that they'll just move on to the next spot.
Yeah, you say South Florida is a key spot for smugglers. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, it's time and time again in our reporting, even at the Miami Herald, we do tons of stories on people being brought in. Mostly we saw this in the Florida Keys. So it is a bit strange that now Coral Gables became a key spot. But again, like I said, smugglers, go to one spot and then they move to the next, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and in these two specific cases you've been covering, what role does the R. Hardy Matheson Preserve in Coral Gables, which runs along Snapper Creek Canal, play in these smuggling cases? What have these migrants been experiencing?
Yeah, so R. Hardy Matheson Preserve is a Miami-Dade County-run preserve that is in Coral Gables. And honestly, not a lot of people probably know about this preserve. It's, overshadowed by the larger Matheson Hammock Park. And it's frankly not monitored very much. It's a park that's in Coral Gables, but run by Miami-Dade County. So Miami-Dade County has jurisdiction, but you don't often see any patrol units out there from Miami-Dade County. I've visited the park a couple times. It has a lot of trash in it, so it doesn't seem like employees go out there often to even pick up the trash that's in the park. So then it became a very easy spot for people to be able to come in on a boat undetected. And basically have people jump off from the boat onto R. Hardy Matheson Preserve from the Snapper Creek Canal.
Yeah.
And it's pretty easy for them to just then, hide out in the preserve until the coast is clear, and then they can just sort of walk out of this park, and into the cars and vans that are ready to take them to their next destination.
Yeah, I personally didn't, and I haven't visited this preserve in the past. And for those listeners who probably have like no idea what we're talking about here, could you explain what that process is like for them? Because in your story, you even talk about people having to hide in the mangroves for some time until things are clear. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah, so we know that there's people that are from witnesses that we interviewed. They seem to have, people on the lookout in that preserve all the time, people posing as fishermen, but never coming out with any fish. We've heard people say that, about five or six people go in and then 20 come out into vans. And it's a big preserve. It's about just over 800 acres. And once you go inside the mangroves, it's you're not easily spotted once you're in there. And then you have people on the outside sort of looking around, making sure that there's no police or anybody around that could possibly report them. And then they can just walk out from the trail. I mean, it's about a 2-mile trail. You just walk out, and then you can just sort of get into vans that are waiting right outside the entrance. on Co Old Cutler Road.
And finally, Milena, what's the city of Coral Gables doing to stop these smugglers from using this route?
Yeah, so I have from I've now visited, Coral Gables a few times doing this report. And even just from being out there, I've seen now they have marine patrols in Snapper Creek Canal, both Coral Gables and Miami-Dade County. They have people out there monitoring, looking out for people. Coral Gables Police Chief Ed Hudak said his department, has sort of fortified patrols along the coastline, and they're dispatching more marine units, and they have more officers out there using technology like drones and night vision goggles to just really keep a lookout for what's going on out there in this usually undetected area. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Milena. Milena Malaver is the Miami Herald's police and breaking news reporter. Thank you again.
All right, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Still to come, red light cameras are boosting city budgets, but are they really helpful for drivers? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. Tim Padgett is out on assignment. Now, let's talk about something we're all too familiar with, driving in South Florida. Love it or hate it, there's definitely an art to it. But there's one thing that probably unites most, if not all, drivers here: red light cameras. The traffic technology continues to stir up controversy and raking in the big bucks for cities like Aventura. Red light cameras make up 5% of the city's budget, one of the largest percentages in South Florida. A state law passed last year is supposed to create more transparency for how money is generated by the cameras and how governments are spending the cash. Some may say the cameras work to improve safety, while others see them as an expensive burden. What do you think? Have you received a red light ticket recently? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero. Danny, how are you?
Thanks for having me, Ellen.
Of course. So you've been covering the red light camera controversy for some time now. What made you focus on Aventura for your recent piece?
So, I mean, you're right in what you were saying to start. It's not a new topic. It's something that's kind of floated into the background. Doesn't mean it continues to that it stopped being controversial, mm-hmm. And that people stopped feeling some kind of way about it. But the focus on Aventura really came because, I mean, honestly, I got a bunch of emails from people more or less at the same time, different people that didn't know each other specifically about Aventura. And I started looking into Aventura, and Aventura has kind of been the focus or an epicenter of these issues in the state. There was a case in 2014 where Aventura was sued over how they were running the red light ticket camera that went up to the state Supreme Court. And, the way that that case ended kind of opened the door to unambiguously make these red light cameras legal across the state. And then here we are over a decade later, and people are still emailing me saying, hey, what's up with this? This doesn't seem right. This is not, like, I don't feel represented as a resident, mm-hmm. that this is good for me. So I looked into it again.
Yeah, you just pointed to a 2014 incident that made it up to the Florida Supreme Court. Could you briefly tell us what changed as a result of that case? Like, did Aventura's red light policy change at all, or any local municipality's policy?
What that case did, the outcome was actually just put it on more or less of a better legal footing, where there was an actual process that had to be made that could be replicated in different parts of the state. Some places were not participating in it because there was when you get taken into court, you're supposed to be able to face your accuser, right? Mm-hmm. And then, if you get a speeding ticket, the officer shows up and says, I saw them speeding, and you say, okay, and you can actually talk to them. In this case, it's a technology. So the question was always, okay, well, I can't talk to the technology. Like, legally, how can you do this? And what they set up on the back end of that lawsuit was, okay, the technology, which is like a third party company, issues the ticket, mm-hmm. but then you have to go before a board in the city or wherever you got it, And then they make a determination, and an officer is supposed to look at the footage and say, okay, yes, send the ticket. So they said, because an officer is involved in the process, it's legal. So after that ruling, a lot of cities move forward with putting red light cameras, and you know, others actually took them away because they were very controversial. Like the city of Miami banned it. Miami-Dade County and unincorporated areas, they banned it. So it is, it continues to be a controversial thing.
Yeah, and like I mentioned at the top, red light cameras make up about 5% of the city of Aventura's budget. Are they planning on installing more cameras or expanding this kind of program?
So I can't say if they're planning to expand the amount of cameras that they're putting. I did contact the city for the story and I didn't hear back, and I tried a couple times. But I can say in their budget documents, they expect to make more money this year compared to last year. They're expecting 17% more in revenue this year than last year. So the program's certainly not slowing down, to use a pun.
Yeah, but like, but like no direct like indication that they're adding anything else. It's just like, we expect to make more money on these cameras this year.
Right.
Okay. And Denny, on the City of Aventura website, it says that the intersection safety program is, quote, designed to reduce the number of violations, crashes, and injuries caused by red light runners. But your reporting has found that these cameras are actually making crashes more common, right?
Right. And that it, that is a bit of a, you know, I did this story. I got some emails from people saying, it's a lot, most of them were saying, thank you for bringing light to this issue. I got a ticket. It doesn't make sense. And I did get a couple from people saying, you know, this is a safety issue, which sounds good. It sounds, you know, you shouldn't run red lights.
Right.
Obviously. But there's actually not been good studies or data that shows that this kind of program makes things safer. It, if anything, it's the opposite, because when these cameras are there, some people that have a lot of momentum that are about to go through a light that's a yellow, if they're making the calculation in their head in 1 second, like, if I keep going, I'm going to get a $158 ticket, or I'll slam on the brakes, they slam on the brakes. So there's a there's even more crashes that happen after these cameras typically go into effect by rear end collisions. So the, you know, the, it sounds a little counterintuitive, but there's no hard data that shows that it may actually makes things safer. It does raise money.
Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm speaking with WLRN's investigative reporter, Danny Rivero, about how red light camera tickets continue to rile drivers as cities like Aventura cash in. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Danny, one Miami Shores resident you spoke to, Sarah Bramblett, received a red light ticket in the mail after going to a medical appointment in Aventura. When she reviewed the video the city contractor sent of her turning right without stopping at what looks like a red light, she couldn't believe it and drove all the way back to Aventura to double check. When she got there, she saw that there was a green arrow that allowed her to turn, and she still got that ticket. Here's what Bramblett said in response.
I initially thought what I often think is, I was right. There is a green arrow there. I did not run a red light. I was correct. I see it. The problem is the camera doesn't see it. You guys are operating red light cameras at intersections, and you're not aware of what the traffic pattern is at these intersections, and that's unacceptable to me. That's unacceptable.
And by you guys, she of course means the city of Aventura. Danny, I have to be honest, when I heard this in your story, I was shocked. I was under the impression that these cameras were programmed to know their traffic patterns. And while Bramblett got her case thrown out, and it seems like a simple tech issue, I'm just thinking about all the other people who could have received the same ticket. Are these cameras programmed to know local traffic patterns?
They should be. And I think this is a little bit of where the where it gets complicated, because the there's a certain amount of faith put in the technology that the technology is going to get it right. And, you know, I watched the video that was sent to her, and you don't see the green arrow. You see that it's a right lane, and there's, you know, some light, some lights have three lights, like the red, the yellow, and the green, and then if there's an arrow, there's usually four lights. So you see there's four lights there, but you don't see anything on the arrow. And then she basically said, like, it looked like I did it. She went back and checked it. It's like, there's a green arrow. And then when she told me, when she went to the hearing, she got pushback from people saying, no, look at the thing. It wouldn't have gone off if the green arrow was on. And she told me, she said, go walk around the corner, go look at the light. There's a green arrow there.
Yeah.
And I mean, a very frustrating situation. And I should mention, after fighting it and bringing her own video and showing traffic signals and whatnot, they actually let her off of it. She didn't get the ticket. But then she was arguing, like, they should review all the other people that got tickets at this light.
Right. Why did I get a ticket in the first place? I'm just thinking, like, I don't know. Like, if there is an arrow there, it should be automatically there. But like you said, it should be. And Danny, we're talking about Aventura today, but your reporting has highlighted other cities who really make a ton of money off of these red light camera programs. Cities like Medley, Opa-locka, and West Miami make even more money than Aventura. Out of curiosity, what city has been most problematic in terms of red light cameras in South Florida, according to your reporting?
So I think, you know, I'll say the city that makes the most money as a percentage of their whole budget, so which means they're relying on this to actually run the government instead of raising taxes through property or whatever, is West Miami. And last year, the city made about 16% of its entire revenue on red light cameras. And this is a small community. It is kind of right in the middle of a lot of, it's in between a lot of areas where there's a lot of traffic. So they do have, you know, some highly trafficked streets that run through there, which is where the cameras are. So last year it was about 16%. And then in the current budget, they projected to make over 20% of their revenue. So like, it's $1 in $5 from the local government they expect to get from these red light tickets, which is a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge number. That's a huge number of revenue to run basic government services that is coming from these cameras.
Yeah. Yeah. And Danny, I mean, yeah, 16 to 20% is huge. Do constituents ever have a say in whether or not their municipalities can use these cameras or have these cameras available?
You know, it's they do discuss these things at public meetings, and there are open to comment a lot of times. You know, it's a question of, do people show up? Do they talk about it or whatnot? At the same time, it's, if you argue, say, in West Miami, like, get rid of these camera, these red light camera tickets, and you're a resident there, you're actually probably arguing to increase your own taxes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just, the money comes from here or there, and they're offloading it to people that just drive through there, essentially. But there have been cases, like in Sweetwater a couple years ago, a city commissioner who's now State Representative David Barrero, who's been fighting these red light ticket cameras basically at the state level, now he's in the legislature, he got it on the ballot to let the residents vote on it. And no surprise, they abolished it in the city of Sweetwater. The residents were not happy with it.
Yeah, and I should point out, I think that was in 2021, right, where Barrero tried to basically ban red light cameras statewide, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know if actually every year, but it's been practically every year, I think I could say, there's a bill or some kind of effort at the state level to ban these statewide, because it continues. I mean, it's, like I said at the beginning, it's kind of become normal, but that doesn't mean that people feel that it's normal or that it should stay that way. There is a constant effort to try to roll them back. And Representative Barrero, that I just mentioned, out of Sweetwater, Republican state representative, you know, he did get a law passed last year which will increase the transparency for these things, so that every city that runs these programs are going to have to show how much money they're getting, where the money's coming from, how they're spending it, and whatnot. And the way that he explained it to me is, he said, okay, this is like the first step in forcing disclosure of these things, mm-hmm. to try to rally some kind of support for actually getting the statewide ban through. You know, he sees that as a first step of like, let's get it transparent, let's get the information out there, and then we can finally close this this thing and wrap up these programs.
Yeah. So what do cities have to present to the state according to HB 1363, which is the state law you're mentioning?
Right. That, I mean, it's basically just from, I mean, they haven't been released yet, I mm-hmm. guess is one thing. The law is in effect now, but they haven't been forced to actually give the first reports. But from the way that the language of the bill is written, they're going to have to say, you know, we got this much money. We used that money for these different pots of things. Like, did the money go to the police department? Did it go to the parks department, et cetera? And some kind of analysis around it. And it'll have to be its own report. And the idea for that is that this won't be something buried in, you know, a budget document that's 1,000 pages that nobody reads. It'll be its own report that residents can actually see for where they live of, here's exactly what's going on with this program where I live. You can look at it, 2-page document or something like that. It just makes it much more accessible.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that will make a difference in municipalities having red light cameras?
I think it'll make a big difference in the way that people are aware of these things. Because, you know, doing the reporting on this before these reports have come out, I mean, Helen, I spent hours, like seriously hours, pouring through budget documents for all these different cities, trying to find these one line items, and they call it different things in different places. It's just like really difficult for a member of the general public who's not an investigative reporter to actually understand what's going on. And that's what I think will change once these reports come out, is that it's going to have to be just very, very simple.
Yeah.
Like, here's a straightforward picture of what's going on in your town with these kind of cameras.
Yeah. And you mentioned a little earlier, like, this is an ongoing thing. This is not news. People, whether they like it or not, like, their red light cameras exist and everyone has an opinion about them. Like you mentioned, in 2024, the legislature also considered a bill to ban these cameras that didn't go through. Have you heard anything about bringing similar efforts back in the legislative session that starts in March?
I have not actually looked it up this session, but like I said, it comes up virtually every session. And, you know, slightly different topic, but last year the legislature did pass a separate bill allowing for different kinds of cameras in school zones, which are being rolled out. It depends on the municipality or the local government. Mm-hmm. So there's more cameras of different kinds going out in different places, even while there's all these efforts to try to roll back in red light cameras. But the other program has to do with schools.
Yeah. I hope we can talk about that at another time, but that's all we have for this segment. Daniel Rivero is WLRN's investigative reporter. Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Helen.
Of course. Still to come, why the city of Miami is shifting millions of dollars promised for new parks. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Helen Acevedo. There's been a lot of excitement in the city of Miami surrounding the construction of Miami Freedom Park, which will be home to the Major League Soccer team Inter Miami's stadium, a public park, and an entertainment district. The team is set to play its first game there in 2026. But before the city and Inter Miami owners signed the contract in 2022, Miami commissioners had a pretty heated meeting. They discussed the ins and outs of the contract and added their own clauses, including $10 million from the developers for new parks citywide. Or at least, that was the understanding. The contract was signed and the rest was history, until last week, when City of Miami Mayor Francis Suarez brought forward a resolution to shift that $10 million back to improving and maintaining the 58-acre park already under construction on Miami Freedom Park grounds. Commissioners approved it. Now, one ex-city commissioner is threatening to recall his former colleagues. We want to hear from you. Call us at 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is WLRN's local government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos. Josh, how are you?
I'm good, Helen. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you. So before we get started, we just want to say that WLRN extended an invite to Mayor Suarez to join us on the program today. Unfortunately, he was not available, but that invitation still stands. The mayor did, however, send us a statement which read in part, "I advocated for restoring the full $20 million back to the park as voters intended." The mayor also said he pushed for additional funds to ensure districts weren't left out. Quote, "This way, we fully fund one of the city's largest parks while still supporting neighborhoods across Miami." Josh, there's a lot to unpack here. To start us off, tell us a bit about how all of this started last Thursday.
Yeah, so this came up. It was first reported by a local blog called Political Cortadito. Mm-hmm. And she basically brought up that on the city commission for last Thursday's meeting on their agenda was an item to create this special revenue fund. It was sponsored. Mm-hmm. The item was sponsored by Mayor Francis Suarez. And it's it was meant to put this full $20 million payment from the developers of Miami Freedom Park, which is the owners of Inter Miami. And it's the Moss brothers, Jorge and Jose. Of MassTech, and so it's to shift that $20 million payment from them fully into Miami Freedom Park for its improvement and construction and maintenance. So basically, when this Freedom Park deal was started, one of the things was that $20 million was going to get paid by the developers to the city for use in parks, and that kind of got in the weeds a little bit, which mm-hmm. we can talk a little bit about later.
Yeah, and let's go back a bit, Josh. So mm-hmm. in 2018, 60% of voters in the city of Miami approved a referendum that allowed the city to enter negotiations with Miami Freedom Park LLC for a 99-year lease. That approval came with a condition, though, right? Which I think you just mentioned.
Yeah, so basically, whenever a city is going to give up a major part of parkland or green space, they have to put it to a referendum. The voters have to approve this. Mm-hmm. So originally, this was the Mel Reese Golf Course, one of the biggest parcels of green space in the city of Miami, and it's right next to Miami International Airport. So the owners of Inter Miami wanted to build a soccer stadium here, and the city wanted to do this negotiation, but they needed approval from the voters. So they put this on the ballot in 2018, but basically giving the city permission to negotiate, but there were conditions, including $20 million from the developers to the city for use either at Miami Freedom Park or in other parks throughout the city. And it also included various public improvements. They also had to build this 58-acre park, which they called Miami Freedom Park, on adjacent to the Inter-Miami Stadium. So in order to sweeten the deal for voters and to allow them to give up this green space, they had to put all these extra benefits that the developers were going to give to people.
Yeah, and that $20 million for green space or Miami Freedom Park is what's at the center of
right,
this whole
exactly.
thing. Right, exactly. Which brings us to the commission's 2022 approval of the lease agreement, where former Commissioner Ken Russell proposed an amendment to include the allocation of $10 million for New City Park, so taking $10 million out of that $20 million we just talked about. But that change was apparently never added to the agreement.
Yeah, so it's super weird, and I can break this down a little bit. So in 2022, the commissioners held a special meeting about this this lease, where they had to the commissioners had to approve this contract if Miami Freedom Park LLC was going to actually build this stadium, build this park. And so there was a lot of wheeling and dealing, a lot of back and forth, because it needed a 4/5 approval. There's five commissioners, four needed to approve it if this was going to go forward. And Ken Russell was the swing vote. He was the last vote because Manolo Reyes was not going to vote in favor of this. Mm-hmm. And his condition, which he was very adamant about, was that he wanted to split this $20 million payment so that half of it, $10 million, was going to go towards improvements at Miami Freedom Park, which is what the developers are building. And the other $10 million would go to build new parks in what's called no net loss parks throughout the city in four different city districts. At first they kind of fought him on this, but he was very adamant. If you don't include this clause, I'm not voting in favor, which means this deal won't get struck. Mm-hmm. Other commissioners agreed with him. Commissioner Joe Carollo said, you know, I think you're right. This money needs to go to the no net loss parks. And Ken Russell actually got the city administration to bring up a list, and it's four properties. They're all city owned. and they all have varying different uses, but they're not parks, right? They're like built up, there's buildings there, it's concrete. And so his thing was, let's split this $10 million. Let's each district will get 2.5 and we'll build new parks there. And if we can do that, I'll agree to the deal. They said yes. The commission approved it. And Francis Suarez even clarified with the commissioners, just to make sure you want to add this amendment that Ken Russell wanted to create this fund for the no net loss parks. They said yes, and that was signed. But when you look at what Francis Suarez then, the legislation that he signed into law, it doesn't include anything about those no net loss parks.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to clarify, no net loss parks are making up for the green space lost from Miami Freedom Park.
Right. So that's a policy that the city has, that several governments have, where if you're going to give up a section of green space that the city owns to be developed on, there needs to be a no net loss of green space. So you need to build parks elsewhere. And so the city had already identified four properties where they could do this. And that's what Ken Russell wanted this $10 million to go towards.
Yeah, and has the city cleared up why that amendment wasn't added to the final contract?
Not yet. So the Miami Herald and myself put in requests for comment and for requests for clarification about why that was not reflected in the final legislation. But we haven't gotten a response back. At least I haven't gotten a response. And the Herald has not reported any response. At the time, we had a different city attorney. It was City Attorney Victoria Mendez, who was removed from office recently. Mm-hmm. And so there's a new city attorney, George Weisong, who was working in that office at that time. So our question is pointed to him, and we don't know at this point. But Francis Suarez, in his proposal, and when he was arguing for it, he said he wanted to kind of go back to the spirit of the ballot question.
Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm speaking with WLRN's local government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos, about the City of Miami Commission's vote to send Inter-Miami's $10 million for city parks back to their own project. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. So, Josh, you spoke to former Commissioner Ken Russell after the meeting last week, right? What did he have to say?
Yeah, he was pretty angry about how this thing turned out. First of all, he went in to speak to the commissioners, his former colleagues at public comment, and said, if you change the conditions of this deal, I will be the first signature on any recall effort of any elected official who votes for this.
And a recall effort would essentially be a movement to remove an elected official.
Exactly. So to remove the elected officials who voted for this, including, he said, you know, Francis Suarez. And he kind of reconfirmed that to me after the meeting. It should be noted, this is Francis Suarez's last year in office. He's termed out, and it's the same for Joe Carollo. But he basically, this is him saying that this is wrong, that you guys are going back on what we said. And to be clear, to explain to people, the problem is that this $10 million in payments, it was going to come from a developer. So it was going to be developer money, mm-hmm, put towards new parks in the city. By shifting that full amount to just the park that the developers are already building, Francis Suarez said, oh, well, let's get $10 million from the city manager. The city manager is going to find $10 million and we'll use that to build parks throughout the city. But that might come from taxpayer funds, or it, mm-hmm, might come from grants, which is also, you know, from the federal government. We don't know where that money is going to come from yet. But the distinction is, what was going to be developer money for parks, it might end up being taxpayer money for parks now.
Yeah. But I do want to ask the question, like, if this was never part of the final agreement, is there any need for the city to even continue with it? Like, if the $10 million was never in the final agreement, how would they have to go back on that if it was never actually in the contract?
That's the question. And I think that's a question for lawyers. And yeah. I know Ken Russell even said so, like, there needs to be kind of an investigation into this, because what's supposed to happen is if commissioners add an amendment to a legislation in a meeting, if they say, I want to amend this to say this, everybody agrees on it, we vote, mm-hmm, on that, then it is the administration's job, you know, the city attorney's office's job, to catch everything that they said that they want to change and put it into writing. The fact that it was not put into writing is strange. And there needs to be a question of who was responsible for that. And does that make the whole contract null and void? We don't know at this point.
Yeah. And some people hear about stadium deals in this city and jump. They immediately try to compare the Miami Marlins park deal to the Inter-Miami deal. But we should make it clear that while there are some similarities, like the fact that they're built on public property or city property, when it comes to funding, they are different. The Miami Marlins Park deal was and continues to be controversial, in part because the stadium was about 80% publicly funded. That's according to the Miami Herald. Meanwhile, the Inter-Miami Freedom Park is privately funded by the owners of the team. And you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but now that the city's losing those $10 million it had from developers, the city is now planning to allocate city funds to these parks. Are they still planning to build these new parks? And have they talked about where that funding would come from?
Yeah, right. And just to clarify, so they're not losing the $10 million. The $10 million is just going to be stuck at Miami Freedom Park. So the developers are going to get to use that the city is going to get to use that specifically for anything going on at that property at the former Mel Reese Golf Course. Mm-hmm. There was this promise to put this $10 million towards new parks in the city. In the kind of discussion last Thursday, when the mayor directed the city manager, I want you to find $10 million before the mid-year budget to put towards parks in all the city districts. It's not clear where that money's going to come from, but it's also not clear like how that money's going to be used, because they just said parks. Before, it was no net loss parks, and there were specific properties that were identified. There was no kind of distinction this time about how the money would get used besides that generally parks. So these districts are going to get park funding, and it's going to be up to the commissioners to decide how that gets spent.
And finally, Josh, while there are some people who don't approve of these changes, others are really excited about Inter-Miami actually having a home in Miami and being able to use this park space in the future. What have you heard from folks who see positives in this change?
Well, I mean, I think people generally, people are very excited about Inter-Miami. They're excited about Messi, obviously. And, there's always the joke that the Miami soccer team plays out of Broward. So I think there is excitement to have that hometown team come here. And also, a golf course, although it's green space, it's not very accessible to the general public. So a public park on this property is very exciting. I think there are some people who are very wary, and especially after this last commission meeting, there were people who came up and said, don't give away our money for new parks. Let us have something. There was a specific public comment where it said, let us have something. Don't let them do this to us again. And I think that's the concern. But when it comes to having a new park and having a new stadium, that's a very exciting prospect, and it should be said the city Miami government is actually going to create a new government building at Miami Freedom Park. So it's going to be like a big hub for the city, and it could be a new central area for it.
Right. The city of Miami is moving their operations to that space once that's done, right?
Yeah. So they're moving from the their offices on the Miami River and the city hall in Coconut Grove. It's all going to go to one new big government building at Miami Freedom Park. That'll be like a government hub where people can go. It's going to be publicly accessible. And hopefully this could be like a really cool community space. I think there is positivity to look forward to here if everything goes according to plan. This could be a really good community space in the city of Miami for people to go to, especially in that area where people might not be so connected to their government.
Right. And this would be one of the largest parks, if not the largest parks in the city of Miami, right?
The city is certainly billing it that way. And Francis Suarez sees this as like the final feather in his cap before his administration is over. This is going to be his marquee project. So he's certainly very excited about it.
Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's government accountability reporter. Josh, many thanks.
It's my pleasure, Helen. Thank you.
Of course. Finally on the roundup, we're just a few days away from the start of sea turtle nesting season. Florida is one of the only places in the country where sea turtles return to lay their eggs. Experts at the nonprofit Loggerhead Marine Life Center in Juneau Beach focus on treatment and rehabilitation of sea turtles. And this weekend, they're hosting a kickoff event to mark this year's season, Turtle Fest.
It's a party for the turtles and a way to talk about sea turtles, the role they play in our marine ecosystem, and the important sentinels they are for the ocean.
That's Andy DeHart, the CEO of Marine Life Center. He says the two-day event is free to the public and will focus on promoting ocean conservation through educational exhibits like the Junior Vet Lab.
It's for younger kids, and they get a rubber turtle that has some type of injury to it, whether that be a boat strike, a cut, or a fishing line. And we actually walk these kids through how would we go about fixing this turtle so that eventually it can be released.
Sea turtle nesting season starts on March 1st and runs through October. Turtle Fest starts this weekend at the Loggerhead Marine Life Center in Juneau Beach. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to your podcast. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Amy Sanchez. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Behrens. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Helen Acevedo. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
WLRN.